This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Today, I am sitting down with Dr. Michael Shermer, the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, whose latest book is Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Michael, thanks for talking.
Oh, good to see you again.
So we are at Freedom Fest, the world's largest annual meeting of libertarians. There's about 2,000 people here at Paris in Las Vegas. Are you a fan of Las Vegas?
Not really.
Yeah. Now, but you're a good libertarian, a good libertarian-leaning thinker.
Yeah, that's right.
Aren't we supposed to love Las Vegas?
Well, you could love it in principle,
right?
Without having to, endorse it personally.
I think I may be in the same camp as you.
I think the best part is Red Rocks. There's some good cycling out at Red Rocks and hiking and climbing.
And you are a big cyclist.
Yeah, I'm still a big cyclist.
So
I ride every day.
What do you enjoy about cycling?
Mainly being outside and the scenery blowing by fairly quickly. You can cover some ground that you can't cover in running.
And it's different than being in a car, even on a motorcycle.
Oh, totally.
Ambient sound is totally
all that. I like all that.
So let's talk about Heavens on Earth. What is the basic argument of the book, and what prompted you to write it?
It was kind of a sequel from earlier works when I've dealt with science and pseudoscience, science and religion, science and God, science and morality. Science is my thing, so the next natural extension was, what about the afterlife? So, the easy low-hanging fruit targets, of course, the religious versions of the afterlife, which have a history, and they don't all agree. The idea of what heaven is or an afterlife changes over centuries. Mm-hmm. Ancient Jews, and therefore the first Christians, believed that when you die, nothing happens. You just go to nowhere. Sheol was this no place that you go to. So there's no perception.
Among early Christians, which I was raised Catholic, and I...
Yeah, the very earliest.
Augustine
bolted on the idea of an afterlife that he got from Plato, of this sort of, there's this... The soul still exists, kind of a dualism,
right?
In these sort of archetypal places where all the ideas are, and so that got adopted.
So when Jesus said that, you're blowing my mind, and I'm not a man of faith, but when Jesus is talking about the fires of Gehenna, which is both a place and a symbol and separating people before the final judgment, and the book of Revelation, which I guess is several decades after the Gospels were written, they're not talking about heaven as we think of it now.
That's right. Yeah, that gets added on later. There, it's mostly symbolic. I mean, people before, say, the late 19th century really read the Bible very metaphorically, symbolically. They would not have asked the kinds of questions that, say, young Earth creationists are interested in today. The flood really happened, and there was this, person or this thing that actually occurred, and it has to be real or else I can't believe it.
So biblical literalism, is part and parcel of contemporary fundamentalism, is really more of a 19th and 20th century.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And it's a reaction to modernity, right?
That's
in the same way that Islamic fundamentalism or even certain types of Orthodox Judaism, you have the Industrial Revolution, and then suddenly certain people want to go back to the way they thought it was in the
past. Right. So because we live in the age of science, and science is taught everywhere, and these are the... You have to have reasons for what you believe and give some evidence for what you believe. Therefore, that trickles down to religion, and so it's no longer enough for most people to say, this is just my faith, this is my tradition, that's why I believe, full stop. Now, some people say that, but when they do, I really have nothing more to say about it. It's like, okay, well, I can ask, why? Do you have reasons? No. Okay. But most people today feel like, well, it has, not only did Jesus really exist and he was really crucified, but he was really resurrected. How do you know? Oh, because the tomb was empty when Mary went there. And then afterwards...
And the Bible is God's breath, the inerrant word of God, even when it's translated and reconfigured by King James's crew in the early 17th century, etc. Have you been to, I assume that you have you been to the Creation Museum?
Oh, yes, I have, the Kentucky one. Right?
Yeah, which is, I was there not too long ago for the second time, and it's a fantastic... installation. I mean, it's a great museum. It's state of the art. But one of the things that was striking to me, and now it's making more sense, based on what you're saying, is the attempts to use the language and concepts of science to explain biblical literalism. And I don't have a particular bone to pick with people like that, but it struck me as odd because they were talking about how, well, the flood did happen,
yeah,
and we're going to explain why fossils are striated, and that's not because the dinosaurs lived hundreds of thousands of years before mankind appeared. It's because of the way the flood waters receded,
right,
et cetera.
Yeah. They call that hydrodynamic sorting, that the water water from the flood will then, as it dries out, and the layers will form as it dries out, it'll look stratigraphied with the fossils in it. And to make this work, they have to have, like, the dinosaurs being too slow and dumb to climb to higher ground while the flood is coming up and that sort of thing.
In most movies, the dinosaurs usually aren't very smart, with the exception
of
maybe
the velociraptors.
Yeah, no, they're good. But you know, they're not book smart.
That's right. But your deeper point at going to that museum is they take you down one of two pathways, and you end up in this hallway if you take the route of science, where at the end it's euthanasia, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and abortion.
And it used to be, this was years ago, it used to be you actually went through a New York City subway car from the 70s with graffiti and scummy people on it. So, yeah. Or you find eternal life and happiness.
That's right. So if you give up Genesis 1:1 or, you know, the first chapter, and say, well, these aren't literal days. They're metaphorical days. It could be a billion years per day, whatever. What does God care? Then you've given up the literal meaning of that passage, which means you might give up the literal meaning of the second chapter, third chapter. And before you know it, the Sermon on the Mount isn't real. The principles and morals and values of Judeo-Christian society are not objective.
Right.
Therefore, there's no way to tell the difference between right and wrong. And America will go to hell in a handbasket without that objective outside source. That's the fear.
Right. And, you know, which is an old argument as, as the Reformation started, or the disestablishment of churches and the flowering under the Reformation and Enlightenment of individual autonomy. This was a fear that if morality is not strictly imposed from without, it cannot ever be generated. But I want to go back to, something you said in passing. So you're looking at heavens on earth, and you said, the religious people are the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you. I'll say for myself, I don't mean that because they're so easy to disabuse. It's just that we've talked about that. The really interesting stuff about your book is the stuff that touches on things like transhumanism and longevity and the kind of secular versions of heaven on earth or heaven after earth, you know, whether we're uploading our brains into into USB drives that then are going to be in new bodies, that's the most extreme version, but intentional communities that get weird. Talk a little bit about those. What is there a common bond that moves from the religious search for utopia or the afterlife to the secular versions?
Yeah, well, in part, it's because on the one hand, we're all aware of the reality of death. We see it around us. 100 billion people have lived before us, and they're all gone. And on the second hand, you can't imagine being dead, because to imagine anything, you have to be alive. So if I say, picture yourself dead, you know, people conjure up, you know, there I am in the casket and my loved ones are there and hopefully they're sad. But of course you can't, because you're still having some sort of perspective and a brain that's observing something. That's not going to happen. The closest thing we know it would be like general anesthesia. You know, it's just boom, boom, lights out, that's it, and except you never wake up. And that's unimaginable. So people concoct easily, because we have big enough brains to do this, some place where something else goes, the soul. Now, libertarians have an interest in this, because they're super pro science and technology. They're mostly not religious, so they agree with me on the religious versions of the afterlife. But they have the same impulse as everybody else, like, well, like Woody Allen, I don't want to live on through my work. I want to live on in my apartment. So how do I do that?
Yeah.
You know, so you have this whole branch of, you know, transhumanists, humanist plus, all these kind of techno optimists like Ray Kurzweil, the singularity's coming, mind uploading, cryonics. All that's super interesting. And in mostly in principle, it's not impossible, just very, very unlikely and difficult to
so
pull off.
So what is there, I mean, this seems to be a profoundly human urge. I'm a big fan of the independent scholar Ellen DeSantis, who wrote a great book about 20 years ago called Homo Aestheticus. And the idea is, you know, one thing that defines human is that we make art or we make things special, et cetera. Do we have, I mean, is there, what is the evolutionary explanation for wanting an afterlife? Or is there one?
Well, maybe. I mean, again, it may just be a byproduct of the fact that we can't imagine being dead.
Right.
And so, therefore, it's easy to project. And so here's the second part, that we're natural-born dualists, that almost everybody intuitively feels like there's another part of me that's not physical. And this is detected very early on in infants. Paul Bloom, for example, does research at Yale in his lab with little children. They get immediately, like in the little puppet show where the alligator munches the mouse and the mouse is dead. And you just ask the little two-year-old, three-year-old, you know, where's the mouse? Oh, the mouse is off, you know, in this other place, and he's hungry, and he misses his mommy, and he's scared. Even though I could see the mouse is there dead in front of him, just a puppet mouse. So the idea that there's some other non-material stuff is completely natural that we feel that way. Just like we have minds, even though we know no brain, no minds, that somehow...
And if we're being honest, you can have a brain and not have a mind
right? That's right. So it feels natural that the mind would just float off the brain when your body dies, and in the same way that a soul would lift off and go somewhere. Now, again, most of the scientists don't accept that in the religious sense, but
right.
They say, okay, what is, who are you? The problem of identity, who are you? Well, you're your complete connectome, the sort of metaphor, analog to your genome. That's all your connections in your brain that represents your memories, your personality, your temperament, everything that we think of as you. How can we store that? And now you get everything from, well, maybe it's in the quantum field, and it floats off into the ether, wherever these weird quantum
right.
effects happen. But more pragmatically, the cryonicists want to just freeze you. So you've essentially frozen all the molecular synaptic connections where memories are stored, and then you bring it back later. Now, to me, that's the best scenario because it solves the problem of identity. The singularity where you make a copy of your connectome, mm-hmm. upload it into as a digital file into the cloud, and then you turn it on, and there you are. This is the same problem that Star Trek fans have of arguing, well, does Captain Kirk really down on the planet and mm-hmm. he's also in the transporter and it's a copy, or is the atoms are scrambled and reassembled at the planet?
So have we made that much progress from the Cartesian cogito of puzzling over consciousness? Are we real or are we being imagined by someone else? I think, therefore, I am, basically because all of the other options don't really leave me with anything to do.
Yeah,
are we just kind of stuck?
We're kind of stuck. That's why the so-called hard problem is called hard, is that you can't imagine what it's like to be something. I mean, what is consciousness? It's what it's like to be you, all your experiences, your quality of experiences. Well, I can't know that because I can't be you. I can only be me, okay? It's a little bit like, what's it like to be a bat? You can't know, Thomas mm-hmm. Nagel's famous thought experiment. Mm-hmm. Although it's a little more complicated than that. But the idea that you could copy this, whatever that is, and store it somewhere. This is the problem of identity. Let's say we copied your connectome and left you alive. Maybe we did this through a sophisticated MRI brain scanner rather than slicing your brain up and scanning it. You'd still be sitting there, Nick Gillespie at the microphone, and then the copy is in some other room. Well, which is the real you? Well, there's two of you now. So this is the problem of identity. Your point of view self would still be sitting here going, no, I'm right here. I didn't move. I didn't float off into the clone copy of me in the other room. I'm still here. And that Nick Gillespie would be saying the same thing. No, I'm over here. And you're going, no, I never left.
Why are we... obviously, I mean, you write a book about it, but beyond that, why are we talking about this so much now? Is this because this might be a ridiculous question. Is this because we have new knowledge to kind of apply to these issues, or is it because we have more time, because we're wealthier and we're living longer we don't have to dig ditches anymore?
That's right. It's a first world problem to have.
Yeah.
You know, like, where do I charge my Tesla battery? You know,
this is a
first world problem to have.
But, I mean, it's fascinating.
We have the time to think about these things.
But also, according to
Ray Kurzweil, we now have the technology to do it.
Hmm.
I think he's over-optimistic.
Right.
But... he makes the argument that if you continue to extend the human lifespan by 1 year every year, when we get to that point, then you can live forever.
Right.
This is his argument. And that we're close to having that that pattern.
Do you want to live forever?
I don't know. I don't even, you know, when they people
and that's
ask
assuming
me that,
assuming you know that your health is good, that
yeah,
you have your
right,
faculties.
Right, yeah.
I mean, this isn't like, you know, you're just a puddle yeah, that's being wheeled that, around.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If that was the case, sure, I would say let's just go on. Get me to 200, and I'll see how it's
right.
going. Get me to 300, and so on. The problem we face at the moment, this I debunked the myth that we live twice as long as people used to. People lived into the 80s and 90s centuries ago, just not very many of them.
Mm.
But now more and more of us are getting up there. So to answer your question, there's time, there's more of us to think about it. The technology is much improved and we have the time to think about it.
And does it matter though, when you scale up from, you know, say random people living to be 80 or 90 to, you know, the average person living 20 years after, you know, one of the things, not too long ago, I interviewed Jonathan Rauch, who has a book called The Happiness Curve.
Yeah.
And the concept of the golden years
yeah.
of a retirement where you had 10, 15, 20 years of good health, sentience, and money where you could just kind of
right.
hang out and,
right.
and enjoy yourself, that's really a post-World War II concept.
That's
and
right.
that really
right.
has radically altered everyday life.
I know. And I don't know anybody my age. I'm 63. I'm about to turn 64. I have a two-year-old. I just, you know, started
wow.
over.
Okay.
I have a two-year-old.
Yeah.
I'm not even thinking, I can't even imagine thinking about retirement. I got my little notice from Social Security, you know, hey, you can start collecting in a year and a half. Like, what? you know, I just want to keep working. And most everybody I know who's
right.
who's intellectually engaged and physically healthy, they just want to keep going. In polls where they ask people, how long would you like to live if you're relatively healthy? Most people say whatever the current lifespan is, like, oh, 80 seems about right. Now, if the current lifespan was 100, people would go, yeah, 100 seems about right. It's what we get used to. So if we got up to the upper ceiling is about 120. So if somehow we broke through the upper ceiling, which doesn't look realistic at the moment, but if you did, then people would go, yeah, okay, 120. I have 6 marriages and 4 careers and, you know, whatever. It's life would change. Now, from a political perspective, we'd have to deal with not overpopulation. I think we could solve that problem. But, you know, what about retirement and this sort of thing? We'd have to these are just solvable problems, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they're technical problems, and then they require a certain kind of political will. Like, we know Social Security is fucked, and it's just a question, are we going to fix it before we're, like, dangling over the precipice
right.
in the Conestoga wagon or
right.
or not? What about utopia on Earth? What is the through line from wanting to believe that when you die, you're not really dead, or that there is an afterlife, and trying to build a perfect world?
Yeah.
And this certainly runs through, you mentioned Augustine, you know, there's, you know, visions throughout his work and certainly throughout Judaism and, you know, actually every major religion has. They're at least striving, and it's probably for a figurative as opposed to a literal, you know, reestablishment of the temple or of like some prelapsarian, you know,
right.
Edenic past, right?
Right.
How is that related to the idea of not wanting to die?
Well, it's in the sense of creating a heavens on earth. Look at whether there's an afterlife or not. Let's see if we can create a perfect society. That's always been this impulse, driven in part by this idea. It's a very classic old myth that there was once a paradisiacal state that we lived in, and then there was a fall of some kind, and now we're going to get back to it if only you elect us or
right.
or support our compound, our commune or whatever.
And it always ends in a compound. That's
yeah,
when you
that's
know
right.
the commune has
yeah.
has gone around the bend, right?
And the basic yeah. and crudest version is the leader gets to have sex with all the members except
sure.
the other members can't.
Yes. Well, so that brings us to another thing I wanted to talk to you about that's not about the book, but you were at an earlier stage of your life. You were interested in the work of Andrew Galambos.
Galambos. Yeah.
He is, to most people in the kind of libertarian, broad libertarian world, in a chapter in the late Jerry Tucilli's. It usually begins with Ayn Rand, which is this kind of comic, semi-fictional account of him running for governor on the Libertarian Party ticket in 1976, 72, something like that. But he meets a Galambosian. And how do you pronounce
Galambos.
It? Galambos. Was famous for saying that, like, he owned the rights to being able to talk about his ideas, so you would sign a confidentiality
right.
agreement. And at one point in the Tucilli book, and it's a very well-drawn scene, where the guy says, well, I can tell you everything, but you have to agree to these terms and you have to pay me ahead of time. And he's like, but why would I pay for something? I don't even know what you're talking about. And he's like, exactly. So
it
who
was really
Columbus?
Like that. It was and, really yeah, like
and
that,
what,
yeah.
What, you know, what were the basic secret ideas, if you can reveal that? And what was the attraction to you about that?
Well, this was in, let's see, 1979, 80. I met a cyclist named John Marino when I got a job at a bike magazine. And so we used to go for long rides and just talk. And he said, hey, you got to take this course from this guy, Andrew Galambos. And again, I was like, okay, well, what's it about? Well, I can't really tell you, but, you know, you're going to love it because, you know, he knew I was a freedom-loving guy and kind of, a, I mean, the label libertarian wasn't, you know, it was like something like that.
Right.
And this was also when Rush Limbaugh had just started. And Marino was like, and there's this guy on the radio, Rush Limbaugh, he's talking about conservative ideas. I'm like, talk radio, what is that?
Yeah. I mean,
okay. So I took Galambos's course at a hotel in Orange County, just staring at a wall, listening to a tape recorder. There was, you know, a guy came in, turned on the tape recorder, you know, at an hour and a half break, you know, then another hour and a half, 3 hours. And I can't even remember what the cost was. But basically it was, and this is so great, you should go tell all your friends. It's like, okay, what do we tell them? Well, you can't tell them any of the ideas.
Right.
So I would say, well, it's about freedom.
So what was the idea? Was it a kind of human potential, human empowerment stuff?
Well, he begins with a property. Property is the foundation of everything. So primary property is you, your body. I think it was your mind and your – no, I think your ideas were secondary property. And then tertiary property was like the stuff you create from your ideas that come out of your brain, from your body. And so he would kind of build this – a theory of property all the way out to, you know, colonizing Mars.
And did
and so
it
on.
Get to the point where, and I get to have sex with your girlfriend or your wife? Or?
I don't think he did that.
Okay.
He was sort of an odd, well, never met him personally, but one of his disciples, Jace Nelson, I did get to know very well, and I worked for his little institute. This is a very common theme among these groups. They have a falling out, and then the person leaves and starts their own foundation. There's another quirky part of it. The problem is inability to actually write anything down in a book. You know, Galambos kept threatening for 50 years, I'm going to write the definitive book. And it finally got written and published, I think just from his notes, after his death. And it was on Amazon for like, you know, $1,500 for the book or something.
Of course.
Like, okay, right. And, I mean, he actually argued, like, Newton, we should all be paying Newton royalties for his idea of gravity, you know, this sort of thing.
So every time an apple hits us on the head, it's like, oh, Newton, we owe you.
Right.
What talk a little bit about your personal journey, because, you know, I mean, you're a publisher of Skeptic Magazine, you're a PhD, you are a cyclist, you worked as a journalist in various capacities that had nothing to do with politics. How did you, and you grew up, or you were living in Southern California during this time, right? So that's like a hotbed of, you know, in the 70s and 80s of human potential, est, all of this kind of stuff moving further up the coast. What was the attraction of that to you, or how did you get involved in this kind of world of ideas?
I think personally, well, first of all, I love science, and I've always loved science, so that part is pretty easily explained. I think the libertarian ideas mesh well with my temperament and personality. And I do think a lot of the direction people gravitate toward liberalism or conservatism or libertarianism has to do with their temperament, what they feel comfortable with. We know from really good studies now on the big five personality dimensions, openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, introversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, O-C-E-A-N, ocean. People that score high in conscientiousness and low in agreeableness tend to like conservative worldview. They like a predictable, hierarchical, structured, law and order society.
Right.
Now, it's not like when you're born, you have these genes that, you know, it's like, who do I feel like hanging out with and what kind of environment am I comfortable with? People that score high in openness to experience, for example, they have more books on travel in their personal libraries. They like to travel. They like to meet new people. They like, they're higher risk takers. They like going to places they've never been and just see what happens. Now, those people are more likely to be libertarian. You know, they're more adventurous. They let's just try something completely new and different and see what happens. And they also don't mind being alone, just sort of being, you know, it's just me and my life. You do your thing. I'm going to do my thing. I don't care about the structure of society and all that stuff.
What is, when it comes to, you know, I don't mean in a partisan sense, but given if people's worldviews or kind of ideologies, like pre-political ideologies, are kind of based on temperament, it's not clear how much you can change them. Like, right. how do you right. sort things? How do you direct? How do you make kind of cultural, large-scale cultural or political change happen?
Right. I was just thinking about this, writing a column for Scientific American on governing Mars. You know, we're right. about to yep. colonize Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And
finally.
And
I hope we're going to bring back all the Robert Heinlein characters that have been up there for decades.
What's the Heinlein book about the Mars?
Stranger in a Strange Land. Stranger in a Strange Land is the one about the Mars colony
right,
and the guy coming
right.
back. Moon is a Harsh Mistress that's is on it, the
yeah.
moon, and yeah. that's like the American
so
Revolution.
So Heinlein was a yeah. libertarian.
Yeah.
So, you know, but there's a lot of people, turns out, that have given a lot of thought to this.
Yeah.
I had no idea. So I started reading, and so here's the problem for tyranny on Mars. There's no oxygen there. So the moment somebody gets a monopoly or control of the oxygen production machine, that's a recipe for
right.
tyranny. So what's the solution to that? Either a communal ownership of the air, or you have lots of oxygen machines.
Or fuck
companies.
It, I'm going to Uranus, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
right.
you know, I mean, because people left Massachusetts, right? The Bay Colony or Plymouth
right,
Plantation.
Right.
It's like,
I mean, when Europeans came to America, they had air,
yeah.
they had water,
yeah.
they had free food.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. So we're going to have to really think this through carefully. Because, like, first of all, if SpaceX goes, can SpaceX, a corporation, own a piece of Mars? You know, according to space treaties, no.
And every science fiction movie made in the past 40 years, you don't want a corporation controlling
that's right.
you know, the means
bad.
Of production and
right,
consumption
right,
or something.
Yeah. But a government
yeah.
would be even worse.
Right.
Because, like,
well, we wouldn't get them.
What if you are unhappy with the government of Mars? You can't just leave. Like, I'm going to go to that
yeah.
crater over there because there's no air. You have to have the whole apparatus for survival. So this is a problem.
So to close out this conversation, and thank you for talking, you are definitely part of a kind of return, a celebration, or an enactment of kind of Enlightenment values in
yeah.
terms of, you know, rationality, science. And none of this is done to just will away the way that culture and tradition and the past shapes us, and the way that biology and culture and environment all interact in all sorts of ways. I was struck, you know, people like Steven Pinker, even somebody like Jonah Goldberg, National Review
right.
conservative, has
right.
written a book called Suicide of the West,
which,
is fundamentally a restatement of a bunch of kind of Enlightenment values that are not what most conservatives believe in, really. But are you excited? I mean, I guess this is always the case. Like, you know, on the one hand, there is more and more crazy, weird, fake spiritualism and occultism. I mean, nobody's really into the occult the way they were in the 70s,
yeah.
Which is a shame for some of us. But, you know, both kind of scientific or pseudoscientific kind of occultism and fantasy life. But then there seems to be this really strong re-embrace or re-articulation of Enlightenment values.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and why is that happening, and is it going to be successful?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Steve's book has been very well-supported, and Bill Gates, gave it a great
right,
endorsement.
Yeah.
You know, best book I've ever read. Okay, that doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
But he's been pretty harshly criticized as well. I just talked to him yesterday. He's got a long response to all my critics. It's one place.
Right.
Here we go.
Now, this is going to be like the Galambos book, though, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be written after he's dead, because he's got a long list of
yes,
people
yeah.
to settle scores. But, yeah.
But not just Steve. You know, my book, The
yeah.
Moral Arc,
right.
Matt Ridley's book.
Absolutely.
Both his last two books, actually.
Yeah.
And
it's fascinating to see an explicit, you know, defense of elements of the Enlightenment or of the Enlightenment process, because I think we can all agree that at any given point, I mean, you look at like Carl Linnaeus or whatever, and it's like the guy was kind of batshit crazy about a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so you don't necessarily want to buy into his racial typologies,
yeah,
but that idea of classifying things and then figuring out how they fit together and then modifying that, you know, certainly with political insights from the Enlightenment, et cetera, it's striking to me. And, you know, reason is turning 50 this year, very much in an Enlightenment vein of the idea, you know, that, you know, we want to get away from arguing from authority or from
right.
status.
Right.
We want to use rationality. We want to explore the world and make it better.
That's right. Problem solving.
Yeah.
That most problems are soluble if you have the right knowledge. And this was the Enlightenment idea of that we, you know, we reject dogmatism and authority and just say, okay, what are the problems we're trying to solve and figure out here? Everything from physics to biology to society. So the idea of like studying the economy like it's a human body. This was the initial analogy, as you know, from laissez-faire was the idea that, you know, blood flows through a body like currency flows through an economy. And if you block it, you know, through too much taxation, this is like disease blocking right. blood flow. You know, but the question was, well, the problem to solve is how do we get more wealth? You know, so treating how do you get more wealth, or even what wealth is? And remember, Adam Smith's book is not titled The Wealth of Nations. It's titled A Treatise on the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. It's the nature and causes. It makes it a science book. That was a new idea. Let's figure out what it is we're even talking about and then try to solve the problem. So, and then the second part is, let's, like the first conservative, Edwin Burke, let's not just throw off everything that's come before right. because people have figured things out. So let's see what the good parts are and reject the bad parts.
And this is, I mean, it ends up in people like Ludwig von Mises or Friedrich Hayek that a lot of things are the result of human action, but not of human design.
That's right, yeah.
And there are rules that are kind of embedded, or wisdom that's embedded in institutions that we can't necessarily understand. So we don't want to just, I mean, we don't want to go French Revolution and just
that's
start
right,
year
right,
zero because
right.
we've got a new system.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on the Mars governance thing. On the one hand, I want to send Elon off with the U.S. Constitution, yeah. the Bill of Rights, you know, some of right. the documents we have that have worked pretty well for
yeah.
a couple centuries. They're tried and tested. On the other hand, maybe somebody will come up with something completely different we mm-hmm. never thought of. And, you know, in centuries from now, it's like, wow, so that's how you do it. It's not democracy, it's this other thing, you know. But on the other hand, it could easily end up with, you know, cut everybody's heads off
and
we'll be the last ones in the crater.
Yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, the Colonel Kurtz kind of
yeah.
scenario seems a lot more probable.
And the reason for that is because human nature isn't yeah. going to change.
So, but about the Enlightenment, do you feel, you know, and it's funny, I hadn't thought about it in these terms of dogmatism. And of course, that's exactly right, that it's about, you know, where, you know, we try to put aside our investment in us being right, and instead it's like, okay, what is the knowledge here, as opposed to what do I want to be true?
Right.
Is that, you know, can we recover that in a world that seems more dogmatic than ever? And, you know, certainly in terms of politics, on the most crass kind of partisan level, things are more, you know, tendentious than ever. But even within the university, you know, there seems to be really strong camps where it's like, no, we don't want to have any cross-pollination. We don't want to have anything that challenges our status quo. So how do we get to a place where we kind of put dogmatism, you know, in the penalty box for a while and get on with playing the game?
Yeah, the academy is really, it's too balkanized. Literally just different scientists in different buildings is a problem. The economists should be talking to the biologists and, you know, working together down the hall. And then this is all made worse in the last couple of years with the rise of identity politics. This is the very opposite direction of Enlightenment values and reasoning. So I am concerned about that. I think we can turn the ship, but socially, of course, I'm a little concerned about Trump, and like everybody is, just because the idea seems to be of a lot of his supporters is, let's just put him in there, blow the whole system up, and start over. No, wait a minute. We've already figured out a lot of things that work pretty well. Let's not blow the whole thing up.
Right.
So there's obviously some psychology going on there.
So you want a kind of like intellectual drone program where we can, but unlike the actual drone programs where we're not just bombing wedding parties because we think they're terrorists,
right.
we're just getting rid of the stuff that's in the way of increase in knowledge, wealth, equality,
right.
prosperity.
Right.
All right. Well, you know, well, let's agree to meet in 50 years on Mars.
That's right. We'll see
okay?
how that turned
and
out.
I'm hoping that podcast technology is a thing of the past by then.
No, it'll be 3D,
interactive. Avatars.
That's
and,
right. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's the best argument for Ray. I hope Ray Kurzweil's right. I'm all for continuing on as long as I can. I want to see how it turns out.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't want to be blindly naive either.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. We've been talking with Michael Shermer. He's the author most recently of Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. He's also the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a columnist at Scientific American. He teaches at Chapman University. You really cannot miss him. You'll probably see him riding a bike somewhere in your rearview mirror as well. Michael Shermer, thanks so much for talking
to
Reason.
Thanks for having me.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie, your host. Please rate and review us. Subscribe to us first, then rate and review us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, or anywhere else. Thanks so much for listening.